Hailing Frequencies Open, and welcome to Enterprising Individuals, the Star Trek discussion podcast that boldly goes into excruciating detail about the series, characters, and stories of the Star Trek universe. I'm your host, Aaron Coker, a.k.a. Caliban, and I love Klingon episodes because they have to reset the days without a workplace stabbing counter back to zero. I'm joined in this episode once again by Fred Love. Fred is a freelance writer and RPG designer who has written for games like Star Trek Adventures and Tiny Supers. He's got a YouTube channel called Tabletop Frontiers, where he live streams role-playing sessions and shares his creative process. Fred, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, good to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you back aboard. Today we'll be talking about Sins of the Father, the 17th episode of the third season of Star Trek The Next Generation. TV in the days of Star Trek The Original Series wasn't much concerned with continuity. Whatever happened to the show that week, next week things would be the same way they always were, and no one mentioned last week ever again. After all, the first episode of Star Trek the audiences saw was actually the fourth one they filmed. Who needed to know anything about the world of the Federation? The writers didn't come up with it until the 19th episode, Arena. That trend, however, began to change with the advent of Star Trek The Next Generation, a series that was premised on the existence of an earlier series. The plan was to continue to produce standalone episodes, and that unofficial mandate continued to plague creative screenwriters through the Berman years. But the continual world-building of successive Star Trek shows and the recurrence of fan-favorite elements and characters turned Star Trek from a Monster of the Week series to a franchise lauded for a half-century of creative storytelling. But we'll talk about that a little later in the show. First, Fred, it's great to talk to you again. It's been a while since we last spoke. I think it was around summer of last year, maybe just before. And at that time, we were just beginning to come to grips with the reality of the pandemic and a quarantine. Now, here we are in 2021, and same thing. Nothing much has changed. How are you holding out still?
Doing okay. You know, raising a family, I've got two children, so raising a family has been it's a big job under the best of circumstances. During the pandemic, it's been even more difficult, but I think my wife just got her second dose of vaccine this last week.
Oh, good.
And
good.
She's a teacher, so she was a prioritized group, and so we've got some light at the end of the tunnel, hopefully.
Sure. Are your children school age?
Yep. My son is in fourth grade. My daughter is still in daycare. She just turned 4 in February.
Okay. So did they do any distance learning, or how was that managed where you are?
Yeah. So my son's school was like, they did different things at various points in the year. So they've been in-person instruction for most of the school year, but they also had days and weeks where they were remote learning. And then they had a couple of weeks where they were doing a hybrid model. And so it was very much just kind of a figure out what's going on this week and be as flexible as possible. And it's worked out okay, but man, it takes a lot of flexibility and a lot of planning, and it can just kind of be exhausting keeping up with it.
Yeah. I can imagine just having to be flexible yourself and kind of keep up with it. And hopefully, you know, we're in circumstances where that's a possibility, but I'm just thinking of all the classrooms and kids who doing remote or distance learning would be such a struggle for them. There's going to be it's like when there's a forest fire, you know, and you cut down a tree and you can see in the rings, oh yeah, there's a fire that year. There's going to be a whole generation of kids who this year is just whatever you learn in sixth grade or whatever, they're just not going to know that stuff, or they're going to have kind of a shaky memory of learning things that year. But hopefully with the rollout of the vaccine, we can get this thing behind us soon.
Yeah, right. There's hope. There's light at the end of the tunnel. And you're absolutely right that the remote learning option has not been equitable for everyone everywhere. And we will be dealing with the ramifications of that, I think, for years to come.
Yeah. I think I said the last time that we talked that Bob Dylan was my soundtrack at that time for the quarantine, but I don't know now. It's like Metal Machine music or Death Grips or something. It's been rough.
Yeah.
I know that you've been adding a lot of content recently to your YouTube channel, Tabletop Frontiers. Can you talk about some of the things that you've got up there?
Yeah, you bet. So one of the bright spots of the pandemic has been that I've been able to do some more freelance writing than I've done in the past. So I've actually spent a lot of time working on new products for the Star Trek Adventures game line. And I've been running a lot of games. Thank God that with virtual tabletops and video conferencing technology, I can still meet with my game groups, and we can still play tabletop role-playing games even during the pandemic. Even though we're not actually physically sitting around a table and doing it, we can still do it online, and it can still be a pretty fun experience and a great creative outlet. And that's exactly what it's been for me during the pandemic. And so on my YouTube channel, Tabletop Frontiers, I've run a couple of Star Trek Adventures campaigns. The one that I'm spending most of the time on is called Star Trek Explorers. It's an original series era Star Trek Adventures campaign set on a Constitution class starship on a 5-year mission of exploration. And so we're trying to kind of strike the same tones of optimism and hope for the future that the original series really embraced. And then I do some videos where I just kind of talk about behind the scenes, the kind of projects I'm working on and my philosophy on tabletop RPG design. And so hopefully it's just kind of a space where I can geek out and be creative and talk about these things that have really been kind of a godsend for me during a really tough year.
Yeah, I can imagine. And it's a certain way to, like you mentioned, interact, if only virtually, with your friends and fellow players. I know that you had written a module before the pandemic started called The Cure is Worse Than the Disease about a pandemic. Do you think that, like, we're going to see a lot of fiction, not just in the role-playing space, but like TV, movies, people sort of working out their feelings about the pandemic with storylines about pandemics?
You know, I think I think you might very well be right that there will be a lot of screenwriters and creative people who are going to want to tell stories using this pandemic as the backdrop. Personally, I would rather do it metaphorically and not necessarily delve into stories specifically about a pandemic. I kind of think of the kind of science fiction that I'm looking for now is escapist and uplifting and aspirational and hopeful, like Star Trek, the original series. I'm not very eager to jump into pandemic storylines in the games that I'm running anyway.
Yeah, it's a little on the nose, I guess. Right? People just suddenly every, you know, movie is about sickness or something like that. I know that zombie movies are kind of making a comeback, and so maybe that is connected in a way. I guess you could always do the Godzilla thing, where Godzilla is often seen as Japan sort of reflecting on its failures in World War II and the atomic bomb and things like that, and then it manifests itself as a giant radioactive lizard.
So
that's a creative way to go about it.
Yeah, allegorical. I think there's a lot of opportunities to tell allegorical stories about the stress and trauma and difficulty of the last year.
Yeah. And I think it will be that, because I was trying to think of what that media would be like if it would involve sickness or involve paranoia. But I think it would also, or mainly chiefly involve the stress and the loneliness and the sense of restriction that, you know, we're feeling by being quarantined. Yeah. I wonder if it's like every movie's going to be like Room, that movie Room that came out a couple of years ago.
Yep.
Looking forward to that. Can't wait. Speaking of things being optimistic, are you looking forward to Strange New Worlds, which just began production recently?
Oh yeah. I mean, what a time to be a Star Trek fan. It's not that I've loved every single thing that CBS has done with the new series, but just, I'm just so excited that there's new, I will never again take new Star Trek for granted. You know, during those years after Enterprise went off the air, and I really thought that the franchise was done for good. And now to be in the year 2021 with, however many live action series in production and an animated series targeting kids on the way. I'm just really excited to have all this new Star Trek content. Really excited for Strange New Worlds. I think the cast looks great. I love the concepts. I'm pumped. Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm really excited for it too. I'm also excited for Star Trek Prodigy, the animated series that will feature, it'll feature Kate Mulgrew as Captain Janeway, or as Admiral. We don't know what Janeway's going to be, but as Janeway. And they announced Bill Campbell is going to return as the outrageous O'Connor.
Yeah, what a weird deep cut, right?
Yeah, that's a really weird deep cut.
But my kids, we've got kind of a Saturday morning tradition where we watch cartoons together. Usually we'll have some sugary cereal while we do it. And so I'm really excited to have a Star Trek series that I can watch with them and munch on some cereal. And hopefully that'll be, my kids have watched some Star Trek. They've watched the original series, Next Generation, and they've kind of seen me. They've kind of, through osmosis and as much time as I spend watching Star Trek, they've kind of soaked up a little bit. But I'm hoping that this will be kind of their real gateway into something they can actively, love for a long time to come.
That's entirely possible. I'm really surprised that they haven't used animation to exploit Star Trek in that way, because, of course, there was the animated series back in the 70s, but when you've got something like a Star Trek show that's a sci-fi show, it's expensive, it costs a lot to make, you know, you think you could just turn it into a cartoon and then keep sort of the fandom going or keep growing new fans. Like nobody wanted to make a Ghostbusters movie for a long time, so they had, you know, the real Ghostbusters, the cartoon. So yeah, I think that it's great that Star Trek Prodigy will be getting back to that space and getting younger viewers watching Star Trek. And I hope that they come up with, you know, do another cartoon, do a Droids or something like that, you know, like right. The Droids from Disco.
Sky's the limit. I mean, CBS is clearly committed to Star Trek as a big franchise, something yeah. that they hope is going to drive people to Paramount Plus. And so I'm taking that as a positive thing and really excited for the future.
Well, the episode we're talking about today is one of my favorites, and I feel like I have to constantly remind myself that it is one of my favorites, and I don't know why. All of the Klingon episodes, in fact, are, I think, very well made, very engrossing, but I kind of forget about them in connection with TNG and to a lesser extent, DS9. And I don't know if you experience that phenomenon at all.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think maybe I do in the sense that I sort of conflate. So, I mean, obviously, Sins of the Fathers is where we get a lot of development for Worf and Worf's backstory. And that got continued in other episodes throughout the franchise, even into Deep Space Nine.
Sure.
And I have a tendency to kind of conflate those episodes into one kind of blob in my mind. So I'm not sure, like, what events happened in Sins yeah. of the Father versus yeah. Redemption and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I get that too. I was convinced that Kalar was in this episode for a while, and then I watched it and was like, oh, no, she's in Reunion, which is like the follow-up to this episode.
Yep.
So, yeah, and I don't know what that is. I think that there are some people, I mean, if you don't like Klingons, then I guess you're right out on these episodes. Like, you're just never really going to really get into it. But the kind of fan that these episodes and their subsequent follow-ups created, I think, is amazing. I was thinking about Klingons and Klingon fans and that subculture, and it's got to be one of the largest subcultures within an already existing fandom. You've got, like, Star Trek fans, and then you've got, like, crazy Klingon fans, and I think that that's fascinating.
You know, I went to there's a local Des Moines science fiction and fantasy convention, and every year there's a group it's the same people, and they dress up like Klingons, and they yeah. walk around the convention every single year. You can set your watch by it. There's going to be a big troop of angry Klingons coming by the table at some point.
Yeah, and I don't know if that exists in any other fandom. Like, you don't have, like, Star Wars fans, and then you've got, oh, these guys are only fans of the hammerhead aliens, you know, the Athorians or something yep. like that. Yep. It's just like this weird thing that you're explaining Star Trek fandom to somebody who's not a fan. And then you also have to then explain how the Klingon fandom works. And it's really fascinating because it's taken on such a life of its own in fandom. And I've also academically, you know, the guy that Mark Ockrand created an entire language for Klingon. And then there's, like, different dialects of that. The way that fans interact with the thing that they love has always fascinated me. And, like, as you say, you know, you can see that at cons, which unfortunately we're not experiencing right now. You know, right. All the cons are shut down, which is really frustrating.
Yep. I certainly miss that interaction. I've done some virtual events which is a great way to stay in touch and connect with people and get some news and some excitement. But yeah, it's not the same as going through the booths and meeting people and playing games and yeah. just talking about the stuff we love.
Yeah. They just announced recently that they won't be doing a in-person shore leave for the second year in a row, which is really frustrating because that's where I met a lot of people who write Star Trek books and write Star Trek role-playing games and things like that. And just not being able to get together with those people is, it's tough. It's one of the hardest parts of the pandemic.
Yep, I miss it.
Well, because you've got these crazy Klingon fans and because you've got crazy Klingon writers like Ronald D. Moore, we get a return to this world occasionally. And I think it's almost the scarcity that makes it, gives it more of a focus on development. You know, if you're just doing day to day, we're running into oil slick monsters. We're running into the planet where the women are in charge instead of the men, that sort of thing. It becomes sort of a an evenness of difference. But when you continue to go back, okay, we're checking back in with the Klingons. What's happening this time? How is the saga of the House of Moak and the House of Duras? What, you know, where are we at that point? I think it really helped to sort of establish that continuity in Klingon stories. And it reminded me a lot of a role-playing game and a table where you've got your characters and, you know, you're going back, you know, every week or every 2 weeks, you're playing this game and you're kind of picking up, all right, where do we leave off? You were in a trap, you know, this guy was turned to stone or whatever it is. And the way that you kind of collectively tell stories at a role-playing table.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. In a role-playing game, when you sort of return to the same setting and the same characters over and over, each time you do that, you tend to add a little more detail and a little more backstory and a little more richness to the world. And I think that's a big part of what happens in Sins of the Father is we see a whole lot of world building and development of the Klingon homeworld and the Klingon culture and Klingon politics that hadn't really been explored before and then would get built upon later in the franchise.
And the thing that you're, you know, for me personally and for a lot of characters when I play a role-playing game, it's all about the character and the characters. You know, if we're fighting vampires this week and robots the next, that's all well and good and exciting, but it's really like having that like knowledge, that, you know, awareness of what your character's done and what's happened to him and trying to decide what he or she is going to do, you know, the next time something happens. That's what really is engrossing for me as a player.
Yeah, agreed. Absolutely. Couldn't put it better, man.
Well, we are talking about the episode Sins of the Father. It is the 17th episode of the third season. It first aired on March 19th of 1990. The teleplay for the episode is by Ronald D. Moore and W. Reed Moran. Ronald D. Moore is Ronald D. Moore. We've talked about him before, and we'll talk about him as we go on here. But W. Reed Moran is currently a lecturer in the Film and Electronic Arts Department of California State University, Long Beach. This is his only Trek work. However, he wrote for several other shows in the 80s and 90s, like MacGyver, Simon & Simon, Baywatch, and The Real Ghostbusters, as mentioned before. The story of the episode is by Drew Dean. Dean also wrote the story for the fourth season episode, Reunion. Those are Dean's only writing credits, but he has also been a sometime actor, appearing first in a small role in 1985's Night of the Living Dead. And he also appeared in the 1985 miniseries North and South, which also starred Jonathan Frakes. And I've noticed that there are some people who, like, Trek is their only credit and they just disappear. And maybe it's only because, like, I don't have a MacGyver podcast, so I'm not looking, like, day-to-day at who's writing MacGyver episodes. But it seems like, I don't know if this is part of their script submission sort of program that they had going on at the time, but a lot of people just do, like, one episode of Trek, and then that's their only writing credit.
Well, I guess if I had to pick one franchise to get my credit in, it would certainly be Star Trek.
Yeah,
a lot of
sub $1 checks appearing in your mailbox, I imagine.
yeah, a lot of reruns, right?
For writing a Star Trek episode. The episode was directed by Les Landau, who has directed a lot of Star Trek episodes, 59 episodes of Roddenberry/Berman Trek. He also directed Star Trek The Next Generation, A Klingon Challenge, the VHS board game from 1993, starring Robert O'Reilly as K'Vok. Did you ever play that?
No, never heard of it, actually.
I remember seeing it and wanting it real bad and knowing I wouldn't be able to afford it and feeling sad about that. And I really didn't like care about the game. I just wanted to watch the VHS tape.
Right. Yeah, I remember that was a trend in the 90s. You get these board games with these kind of atmospheric VHS tapes that go with them. Yeah, that was a big trend.
We did have the Clue VHS board game, and I did just watch that. I don't think I ever played it with the board, but I watched all the little scenarios and everything. And it's like, it was fun. It's just a bunch of, like, you know, community theater level actors on bad sets. But yeah, I wanted to see Robert Riley as this different character, K'Vok. The start date for this episode is 43685.2. And your assignment, Fred, if you can, is to give us a 25-word synopsis of Sins of the Father.
Oh boy, okay. Worf's long-lost brother teams up with Worf to queer the name of their dead father.
And there's no real side plots. It's kind of just that.
What struck me about it was just how much happens in this episode. In my mind, I sort of wondered, was this a two-parter? Because it just, boy, it seems like really compressed. There's a lot of plot in here, even though there isn't like a B story or anything. A lot happens in the A story.
Yeah, it's very efficient. And it's, you know, it's in Trek's third season, so they really kind of had their heads on straight at this point. But just the other day, I was watching an episode from the second season, Up the Long Ladder, and there are like three subplots going on at once. And there's like a D plot as well, A, B, C, and D. And it's the one with the Irish farmers and the clones. So they're running through, it's almost like they had a couple premises but couldn't make them all work. And so they just stuck like a bunch of different things. So the Enterprise is bouncing around and Pulaski and Worf are having a Klingon tea ceremony and there's all these things going on. But this is almost like a movie. They set it up and you just follow the story all the way through to its end.
Yep, it's pretty focused.
This episode was the result of the combining of two different scripts, one by Drew Dean, which featured a story about Worf's father being accused of treason, and one by Beth Woods, who's a screenwriter, and she wrote a script about Worf's brother coming on board the Enterprise. And Ron Moore was given both scripts when he joined the writing staff, and he was asked to combine them. And W. Reed Moran was asked by Michael Piller, the showrunner, to work with him. But Moran was taken off the job after the first draft because of his unfamiliarity with the series. And Moore and Piller himself saw the script to completion. So I think it's definitely Ronald D. Moore's kind of focus as a writer and a focus on the Klingons. And then also, you know, having the boss help you out will probably get your script to be real clean.
Yeah, you bet.
At the time of the episode's creation, many of the ritual Klingon lines simply didn't exist. So Moore had to create them from scratch, such as Picard's line when he accepts the role of the Chidich. I think in the draft, he just says like, yes, in Klingon or something like that. But instead, you know, Picard has this line that he gives him. Picard actually, Patrick Stewart actually officially requested that from Moore. And we get a few firsts in this episode. This is the first on-screen depiction of Kronos. Of course, it's the first appearance of Kern, Worf's brother. It's also the first appearance of the Captain's Dining Room set, which was a redress of the Observation Lounge or the Briefing Room set. Speaking of the sets, the set design in this episode earned the production an Emmy Award for Best Art Direction for the production designer, Richard James. And this was a fairly well-received episode. Entertainment Weekly ranked it at number 7 on their list of the best 10 episodes for the show's 20th anniversary. And of course, 20th anniversary, we just had the 30th anniversary. I was thinking about how I'm going to feel when Star Trek The Next Generation is 40 years old. And it's not good. I won't feel good.
I mean, I literally grew up with it. I was in elementary school when Star Trek: The Next Generation was really reaching its stride and becoming kind of a cultural phenomenon. And I've grown up with it. Yeah, it'll be weird to think that it could be 40 years old.
It's like I Love Lucy was old, you know, when I was young. And it's really old now. So it's always just kind of existed, especially being in black and white, it helps. It's always existed as like, oh, it's this old artifact. But yeah, when TNG is 40 years old and is essentially as old as Lucy was when I was young, I'm going to feel really strange about that. Let's talk about the guest stars in the episode. Charles Cooper appears as Kempek. He would reprise the role in the fourth season episode Reunion. Cooper also played General Cord in Star Trek V. Cooper's career in Hollywood spanned 7 decades. He was a frequent face in guest roles on television until his death in 2013. Patrick Massett appears as Duras. He would also reprise the role in Reunion. Massett got his start in Hollywood in the late 80s as an actor, but he would transition into screenwriting in the 2000s with his work on the screenplay for the first Tomb Raider film. He would go on to write and produce for several shows in the aughts and the teens, as well as return to acting in the role of Willie Gault on Friday Night Lights. He's currently the showrunner for the live-action Sword Art Online series for Netflix, which is currently in development. Thelma Lee appears as Kayleste. Lee got her start in showbiz as a comedienne, and she appeared on The Ed Sullivan Show in 1963. She would go on to roles in TV and film across her 3-decade career. She passed away at the age of 95 in 2012. And of course, Tony Todd appears in the episode as Kern. Todd would return as Kern in 3 more episodes of Trek, Redemption 1 and 2 in TNG, and Sons of Moke in DS9. He also played an elderly Jake Sisko in the DS9 episode The Visitor, and an Alpha Hirogen in the Voyager episode Prey. Todd has over 200 credits on his IMDb and has been a constant presence in film and television since his debut in 1986. He's appeared in films like The Rock, The Crow, Final Destination, and of course he played the titular role in the 1992 thriller Candyman, its sequels, and in the revival film.
Man, what a career. And he's great in this episode.
Yeah, and he's like, When I heard that he got his start in 1986, you know, I was like, what did he do before that? Because he was born in the 50s, and he's not really that old, but he got a start as an adult, I guess, and has done so much since then and been in so many things. And I didn't even mention, like, his voice acting work. He's done a ton of voice acting and did voices for the Transformers movies. And, yeah, he's just working all the time. I saw that he was he did like 15 episodes on a soap opera in like 2013. And, you know, I mean, like, as an actor, like, you know, a job's a job. But I wonder if that was almost like, oh, I want to knock that off my bingo card. I'm going to do a soap.
Yeah. What else has he got left to prove, right?
Right, exactly. Because you know that his phone's going to ring and somebody's going to want him to play like a heavy or something in a movie, and he's good to go. But yeah, he is great in this. Let's talk about the episode itself, and let's talk about Ronald D. Moore and his contributions to the Star Trek franchise. Known as the Klingon guy, I think, around the TNG writers' room, because he wrote all the Klingon episodes. And I love the fact that, you know, as we talked about before, this was a setting that we could return to, we could continually build on. You have a character like K'Lar, who, it's just a fun character. She comes in, she, you know, challenges Worf and his beliefs about himself and being a Klingon. And then who knows if we'll ever see that character again. And then we have an episode like this where, you know, Worf's got a brother and there's this problem with his father's honor, and that's fine. And then we get to an episode like Reunion and we can just stick all that together. So now K'Lar's back. Oh, by the way, we have a kid and Duras is going to kill me. And I just love the fact that they're almost running this, like, spin-off Klingon show, like, inside of TNG. And Worf goes from the guy who just gets knocked out by the alien to a really deep and kind of nuanced character as this series and, of course, DS9 goes along.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's hard to come up with another character who had so much character development over so many years in two different series. So I think Worf is one of the most developed characters in the Star Trek canon. And a lot of it starts here.
Yeah, it does. And I wonder when, like, the tide turned, or where, or when the light bulb with a money sign in it, if that's a thing, went on over the heads of content creators, where they went, you know, we've been doing these shows where, like Lost in Space, where they're just on, now we're on the planet where plants are red instead of green or something, and we're just going week to week, and we're selling, you know, with soap in the commercials, to the point where they go, no, wait a minute, this is a franchise, we're going to sell tie-in media, we're going to sell spin-offs, we're going to sell role-playing games, we're going to sell stuffed animals. And to do that, we need to have characters that people love and have experienced over the course of years and grown attached to. So we have to have continuity. Like, I'd like to ascribe it all to just a good yarn, you know, what happens next? What's the next chapter to storytelling? But some of it has to be the commercial element as well.
I mean, I wouldn't doubt that whatsoever. Obviously, you want to sell your toy, Birds of Prey, and your D7 attack cruisers and stuff. Yeah. But I just think that I think the writer, one of the things that made me fall in love with The Next Generation at such an early age was how deep and real the world felt, and what a great job of world building and consistency that they built into the series that I never really experienced anything like that before as a young kid. And so I don't know. I think maybe there were definitely artistic goals involved to make this world as believable and consistent as possible.
Yeah, certainly. You know, I believe that, like, Gene Roddenberry, you know, had an idea about a show like this, and he wasn't too concerned, I don't think, with continuity or even coloring in the edges of the world. You know, it was people that came after him or worked with him, like Gene Kuhn and Dorothy Fontana, that really came up with a lot of the details and ideas about the Federation and what life was like on Vulcan. And when he developed TNG, I think there was a question of whether TOS would even be canon, adapted as it was, of course, from their work on Star Trek Phase 2. I think Gene's idea was just, well, it's canon until, you know, we want to write something that just contradicts it, and then right. It's not canon.
Right. Yep. And I'm so glad that there was this effort to make it all seem cohesive, and that it all takes place in the same universe, and there's just a million different stories to tell in this setting, because to me that it just seems like this universe you can sort of jump into and live inside, and that the rules apply everywhere. It just, yeah, I think it's a pretty remarkable accomplishment in the history of popular culture.
Yeah, that's something that's valued a lot by fans. It's also something that causes like new entries to the series to be rejected or criticized by fans. You know, I'm thinking about, of course, Star Trek and some of the new shows in Star Trek, but also something like Star Wars, where it's like, look, guys, like Mark Hamill's not going to be around forever. We have to come up with some new heroes for you to root for. And when they try to do that, you know, the fan base violently reacts to these new things.
Yeah, so when I've been reading some of the old DC Star Trek The Next Generation comic books and reading the letters to the editor page, it's just hilarious because it's people in there saying like, you know, the Star Trek The Next Generation is not real Star Trek. And you know, these kind of angry, that's just hilarious to read now because it's become a beloved part of the franchise. We know how it all turns out. But at the time, you know, in the late 80s, that there was definitely not that that understanding among the entire fan base whatsoever. And then we're going through the same thing today. I mean, what's old is new again.
Those DC stories themselves are just like a twisted path of continuity where they're trying to tell their own original stories, but then they keep making, you know, the TOS films. And so every time a TOS film comes out, they need to find a way to get the characters and the ship like exactly at the point, you know, where they are when the movie happens. And then after the movie takes place, they go, okay, now we can kind of do our own thing again.
Yep. And the writers of those tie-in works, like comic books and the early novels, you know, we're working on a flawed understanding of the characters because the show was so new and the writers of the show were changing things. And it would have been really hard to keep up, you know, to write a comic book in 1987 that was 100% accurate and in keeping with what we were going to see on screen because the show hadn't been finished yet. It was still very much a work in progress.
Yeah. It occurs to me that the Klingon episodes of TNG were maybe some of the first forays into long-running continuity for the series. Up to that point, there were suggestions of, you know, obviously the entire series is predicated on the existence of another series, and you have, you know, DeForest Kelly on the first episode, but, you know, they tried as much as possible to just make it a new adventure every week. And this is the first time that you kind of had to remember what happened in Sins of the Father to enjoy reunion. And you've got, you know, elements like even in this episode at the beginning, they mention Riker serving on the Pach in A Matter of Honor, which you don't have to see to understand the officer exchange program. But it certainly is a little callback to something that happened before.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that you're right, that this is the beginning of some serialized storytelling that we'll see, particularly with Worf's character, his story arc of his relationship with his Klingon heritage, the honor of his father, and his place in the Klingon Empire. Those are stories that we're going to continue to see play out for years to come, and it all, you know, this is definitely the foundation of those stories right here.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that is down to Ronald D. Moore. I don't know how many of his other series you've seen or if you're a fan of his, but I feel like he always tries to leave the characters with something to grow on. You know, he always tries to always wants the characters to walk out of an episode different than when they walked in. And not only is that interesting, like the interesting choice is for Worf to accept his commendation, not to just, you know, kill everybody and win. I mean, he does get to kill Duras later, but that's a different story. But that's the more interesting, and then it leaves you open for more potential for drama in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. The idea that Worf has to accept this commendation and accept this dishonor, and as I understand it, he does this to protect Kern. Yes. Right. Otherwise, you know, he was willing to accept being executed. But then Duras is like, well, if we did that, then your brother is going to come for revenge and he's going to have to swear a blood oath or something. Yes. So Worf says, well, then I'll take discommendation and I'll protect Kern. It's a really selfless thing for Worf to do. But at the same time, I think they're also acknowledging that like Worf is living to clear his father's name on another day.
Yeah. Yeah. And that threat is already there when we see Kern attacked and stabbed in the episode. I mean, Tony Todd's a big guy, and I'm sure Kern can take care of himself, but how many Klingons can he fight at once? Yeah, so eventually there'll be too many Klingons. I used to play a play-by-email sim back in the day, mm-hmm. And just for audience members who don't know what that is, before we had advanced instant messengers and things like that, you just had like a forum or a board or a mailing list where you would all agree that you're on a certain Star Trek ship and you can describe your character to people and then you can write what your character does. And if the sim allows it, write what other people's characters do. And when I used to do that, I always used to write with that in mind, trying to have even if it's a short thing, have somebody change, have somebody challenge, leave it, you know, leave somewhere to go at the end of every entry that I did. And I would often I would read other players' bios and get to know their characters really well and then try to put some words in their mouth that I thought, you know, they would say, and then set them up to do something else. And probably 1% of the time that other player would pick up on that and then continue the story. And that's how I feel about Worf and what Ronald D. Moore would do often. He would set him up for some great future episode, but then he'd just end up being the one that wrote it later. None of the other writers would have Worf doing anything.
Do you think people still do play by email games?
They
like
must.
That? Is that a thing that still happens? I did a couple when I was younger.
They must. I have a couple followers on Twitter who I know they do Twitter role playing, where you just, you know, you pretend to be a character or one of the characters from the show. And I'm sure that they have Discord channels, you know, where they do in-person stuff. But yeah, as far as it's not snail mail, it's email, but the slow email way of doing it, I don't know about that.
Well, that's a blast from the past, man.
I used to do that. Oh man, that was all of my free time. Cause I was in a couple different Sims and you would just write pages and pages. And then at some point I realized if somebody else wrote pages and pages, would I want to read it, whether it was good or not? Maybe I'll just do a couple paragraphs. Yeah. But that's not what Ron Moore is doing here. He's trying to create opportunities for more storytelling for these characters. And I think he certainly does. I'm sure Michael Dorn is a nice guy, but I bet he probably gets Ron Moore a bottle of whiskey every Christmas.
I wonder.
Work that he's gotten out of the Star Trek franchise.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, as a DM, you know, we were talking before about role-playing games. Role-playing games are all about continuity, at least the long-running ones. As an adult, you know, time is always a problem with role-playing games. And I find that a lot of the role-playing games I've played recently have been short or been one-shots.
Yeah. So, I mean, I like to run a pretty kind of wide variety. I've got longer campaigns. I've got games where I've got sort of an idea that we're going to do maybe a half dozen sessions where I'm telling kind of a self-contained story. And then there's one shots that you can play in 2 or 3 hours. And I think that those all have their place, you know, that can help you learn a system or, just tell a self-contained story that's kind of its own statement.
A lot of the there's a lot of games now that are designed exclusively for short games.
Yep.
A lot of things that I've done recently is play games like Dungeon Crawl Classics, where you're literally just randomly rolling your character, and you are not expected to survive that scenario. You know, don't get too attached. If you got a guy that's been around for more than four games, he's a grand wizard at that point.
Yeah, then maybe give him a name. Otherwise, don't even bother.
Yeah, right. And it reminds me a lot of the craze of roguelike games, which is still going strong, where people, you know, ostensibly you can just sit down and play, you know, a couple rounds, get through it. But I have a couple different roguelike games like Hades, and I've put more hours into Hades than I think any game I've ever played, just trying to get better at the game, this game that you're supposed to play only in short bursts.
Yeah, you're not the first person. I've not played Hades, but you are not the first person I've heard say that.
Yeah.
They've really fallen in love with it.
It's really great, and the writing is really great because they take these mythological characters that you're familiar with from Greek mythology, but they give them their own personalities. And then because you are dying so much, it's a very difficult game, and you are playing through it again, you'd think, oh, I'm going to get sick of that one thing that guy says over and over again. No, they've got thousands of lines of dialogue that are not only written, but are voice acted as well. So it's a very impressive game.
Cool.
That's my commercial for Hades in this episode. I saw a tweet from you recently about that you're running a session and you were preparing all the work that the players were going to go through. And then just metaphorically, they didn't go through that door and you ended up having to basically just wing it for 3 hours.
Yeah. So, you know, to me, that's the real beauty of tabletop role-playing games, whether it's Dungeons and Dragons or Star Trek Adventures or whatever it is that you're playing, the real magic is when the game master kind of strikes a balance between having something deep and rich prepared, but then giving everybody enough leeway that the story is really taking shape organically, depending on the choices that the players make. And so just recently, I've been running I rarely run Dungeons and Dragons anymore, but a couple of my buddies from college wanted to play it. They never played it before. So I said, okay, yeah, let's do a D&D 5th edition campaign. And it's actually just been a blast staying in touch with these guys. But I had this like pretty intricate series of encounters prepared for this dungeon that I thought everyone agreed was where they were going to go in the next session. And then at the beginning of the session, they just immediately went in the opposite direction and wanted to do something else. So we're improvising the entire time. There's nothing that I prepared for that evening that actually made its way into the game. Yeah. But I don't think they noticed. I think they thought it was like a normal session, and it was literally, I did not know what was going to happen until we started rolling dice. And that was really, to me, that's the real strength of tabletop storytelling.
It reminds me of when I was very young and just getting into role-playing games. Like we didn't think about long-term. We didn't think about like, I've spent all weekend like writing out this adventure. You know, we would just make it up on the spot and not really think about it. And how, when I run games as well, like that part, like the improvising, coming up with stories on the spot has never been a problem for me. It's been improvising the mechanics of the game that's always a problem for me. Like, I feel like I know the rules, and as a player, I don't have any problem with that. But as soon as I'm challenged, you know, on a roll or something like that, and I have to kind of know the stats and features of like five different types of characters or classes, then I kind of fall apart and it's like, okay, hold on, get out the book, and I have to look through everything. And one of the things I've really loved about gaming in the 21st century is all the digital tools that make that a lot easier.
Yeah. So I tend to be the kind of game master that doesn't really sweat the rules too much. There's this saying that goes around RPG Twitter that fun trumps story, trumps rules. And that's kind of the hierarchy of your priorities. So if my players come up with something really fun and I'm worried that the mechanics might get in the way of that fun, I'll generally just kind of hand wave it, you know? And that generally is my philosophy when running games.
Yeah, that's a good way to go. But I can't play with that on iPad anymore. As a kid, I used to roll characters in my head. You know, you just roll the dice. Okay, you get a plus one to that. So now your strength is 15, and then just write it down when you get somewhere. But I can't do that anymore.
Yeah, being able to search those PDFs is helpful. You can do
that. Yes, yes. Gaming with a laptop all the time. I'm surprised that for as important as Worf's father is as a character to him and subsequently the series, we never see him portrayed in any way on screen.
Yeah, what was the name of that episode from really late in TNG? Or maybe it's early. No, I think it is late in TNG where Worf thinks maybe his father's still alive and he goes to that camp.
Yeah, Redemption, right?
Is it Redemption?
Birthright.
Birthright, yeah. And it turns out he's dead. I think they start out on Deep Space Nine and some Uridian tells him Moog's still alive. And so Worf sets off to find him. Yeah. Oh, yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
Cromwell.
Yeah, it's just so strange. With all the technologies and all the weird things that happen on Star Trek, you think that that would have happened. You know, B'Elanna gets to see her mother on the Barge of the Dead. Apparently, Ronald D. Moore's early idea for the DS9 episode Soldiers of the Empire was for Worf to encounter Moog in Greythor, or a vision of Greythor.
You know, I think that there's an argument to be made that it was probably for the best that we never saw him, even in like a flashback or some kind of vision or anything like that, time travel. It's like maybe like a Uncle Ben kind of thing in Spider-Man, that Moog's dishonor has such a long shadow over Worf's character that, you know, suddenly taking that shadow away might have hurt the character.
Yeah, every time they reboot the Worf show, we got to see Moog get shot again.
Right.
Worf is an interesting character because he comes from this culture that is so obsessed with identity, and he himself is kind of obsessed with identity, but he was raised by humans as an alien and now serves in an alien navy, and yet he's almost like the perfect Klingon because of his insecurities. He's always checking, he's always testing himself against his idea of the Klingon ideal. He's very orthodox. And I think that that's a very fascinating way to depict a character like this. I think if you, and I don't think that they were thinking about, you know, the idea of being a stranger in a strange land, being, it ends up being a metaphor for like religious, you know, or cultural observance, you know, in another country. But I don't think they intended that when they first started out. I think that was an emergent property of the character.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I think Worf is certainly overcompensating for the fact that he didn't grow up in Klingon society. Yeah. And so he's overcompensating, trying to be the paragon of Klingon virtue. And I think that there's kind of a parallel sense of Klingon culture writ large that we see in Sins of the Father, where these Klingons are so obsessed with honor and the power of their houses, but they're willing to basically tell a lie and live with this lie to keep the peace in the empire. So they proclaim that honor is so important to them, but really we see underneath the surface that it's all kind of based on lies and power.
Yeah, he's kind of like he's like the soldier that like has been through 300 hours of simulated training, and then he gets into real battle, and he's like, it's not like it is in The Sims at all.
You know, exactly. Yeah.
He's been a Klingon, the perfect Klingon based on the handbook, and then he gets to, you know, to interact with actual Klingons, and like a lot of them don't care at all about honor and just make a good show of it. That's why like Gowron is one of my favorite characters in Star Trek. And I know that he is a terrible, terrible person, but he almost represents like the apotheosis of the new type of Klingon, you know, the Klingon of intrigue and having principles when it suits you. And there's definitely a political metaphor or allegory to observe there in somebody like Trump, who is this figure who is a populist and he says the right things and he's almost kind of hacked like the political system to great success. I think Gowron has a very similar rise in that he's the good Klingon when he needs to be, while, you know, holding a kutlush behind his back. And, you know, he gets what he deserves at the hands of our man, Worf, you know, the guy who wants to be the perfect Klingon.
Yep. I think we definitely get a huge dose of Klingon politics in a lot of these Worf stories. And it's such a different feel from what we get through 95% of the rest of the franchise. There's this kind of Shakespearean tragedy vibe to it. You don't know who you can trust, and there's betrayal and people with daggers in the shadows. And, you know, even when we see Kern on that transporter pad at the very beginning of Sins of the Father, he's sort of like draped in shadow, and he's this big, like 6'5" imposing figure. And so there's this like, mythic or Shakespearean quality to the Klingon stories that you really don't see a whole lot of anywhere else in Star Trek.
Yeah, it's really fascinating because all of the problems are solved so easily. There's just a beam, or, you know, there's a speech from Picard, but all of these Klingon problems are just so inculcated in their society. There's not going to be an easy a solution for them. Although maybe Worf is the answer. And I was thinking about it, like, what a disruption Worf is to the Klingon Empire. Like, if you see, you know, Sins of the Empire as the sort of stone being dropped in the water, and the ripples that will come from this, from Worf's discommendation, from the death of Kempek, you know, eventually in Reunion, where that leads for the Klingon Empire is huge.
Yeah, I'm sure Kim Peck, when the Enterprise shows up in orbit around Kronos and Worf is there to demand they hear him out about how his father has been set up as a scapegoat, I'm sure Kim Peck was just like, you've got to be kidding me.
That would have been a very bad day. Why is this guy back? Yeah, he wasn't supposed to come back. Yeah, it's funny because if Kim Peck had died, he just, you know, he would have died. And then Duras would have became chancellor and been a terrible chancellor, but he would have died eventually and things would have just kept going on. But, you know, we haven't really looked into it, and hopefully we will if there's a Worf series someday. But I think the Klingon Empire is probably headed in a better direction because Worf decided to honor his brother's wishes and come back.
Well, I hope so. I mean, eventually we do see that there is a short-lived Klingon civil war where the Duras clan, the Duras house, teams up with the Romulans, but that conspiracy is eventually exposed in no small part thanks to Worf and his friends aboard the Enterprise. So yeah, I think that they probably, in the end, brought Klingon politics to a more honest place.
I was trying to piece together the history of the Empire, and I have a lot of friends who are really into the Klingons and can probably tell you their own headcanon version of the political evolution of the Council. But I was surprised to remember or to hear again in this episode that Kempek has been the longest serving Chancellor of the High Council. And it reminded me of it reminds me of Queen Elizabeth in a way. Like, there's this sort of, I wonder if the Klingons are also going through a Pax Klingonia, if you will, and their politics and their civil wars have kind of settled down because of the signing of the treaty with the Federation. Mm-hmm. And so things have been okay for a while. And so you've just got this kind of wishy-washy chancellor, and that's fine. There aren't any real problems. But, that is going to come to an end someday. And a lot of people are wondering about the British monarchy. You know, the Queen's not going to be around forever. And if she dies, will Charles become king? Will William one day become king? Are we going to keep doing this? Or are we going to finally address the fact that maybe this is an outmoded way to run a country?
Yeah, I think that sense of palace intrigue is definitely a big part of the appeal of the Klingons, the way that they are starting to be portrayed at this point in Star Trek history. I love the idea of these great houses kind of vying for influence and trying to figure out who's next in line and who's got the dagger hidden behind their back in the shadows. I think that's pretty fun, pretty good storytelling.
What do you think a balanced, a socially positive vision of the Klingon Empire would look like? Or can there be one? Can there be a good Klingon Empire?
Well, we don't really, at least on screen, I don't know that we get much of a sense in the Next Generation era of the other non-Klingon worlds that are part of the Empire and how are they administered and how are they treated. And I suppose that would go a long way to answering the question. Is the Klingon Empire, are they like benevolent rulers or are they, subjugating people? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question because I don't think it was shown on screen.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think a Klingon Empire that there's a certain amount of rot at the core of Klingon society, I think, when they espouse these values like honor and truth and loyalty. But the real story is they're willing to accept this huge lie just to keep, an important house happy.
Yeah, and they've been around for a long time. And of course, empires sort of ebb and flow as far as their philosophies go. We see in Enterprise, the episodes that Uncle Phil was in, we see that there's a tradition of science and exploration in the Klingon Empire, but it's in decline because of certain elements in the government. So, yeah, I don't know. We're all about utopianism these days. We're all about like showing, this amazing future. Like, I'd like an amazing future for the Klingons. I'd like to see what a happy Federation like Klingon Empire might look like.
Yeah, you've got to kind of stitch together these various eras of the Klingons that we've seen depicted on screen, from the Augment era to the war with the Federation that we see on Discovery, to how they are in the Next Generation and beyond. You've got to kind of, I think, maybe write your own headcanon about how Klingon society evolved from one era to another.
Yeah, yeah. I also like the fact that Klingons are very direct people, and when Kern, realizes that they're going to have this problem, he doesn't just send an email to Worf saying, "Hi, Worf, so I'm your brother. I know you don't know about me. We got to fix this." It's like, no, what I'll do is I will set up that I am exchanged as an officer to the Enterprise. Then I will taunt Worf by not taunting him. That's how Klingons are mean to people. They're nice to them. And I'll be nice to him until he tries to attack me. And then it's like, yes, that's the Worf. That's the Worf I need.
I love those scenes of Kern on board the Enterprise for exactly that reason, because that seems like such a interesting way to get under Worf's skin by being so hard on literally everyone else on the ship except for this one guy. And singling Worf out like that is exactly the way to get under his skin and get a response from him. And the way that everyone on the bridge crew is sort of grumbling about Kern's discipline, it's like exactly like a workplace when a new manager comes in, with different ideas about running things, and everyone's like trying to find their allies in the office and trying to figure out how long is this going to last, and this isn't the way we do things around here. This isn't a Klingon ship. I love that.
And ostensibly, the goal of the exchange program is tolerance, ultimately. I don't think anybody needs to change too much. It's funny that Riker goes to the Klingon ship and has to act like a Klingon, but Kern can just threaten to kill everybody on the Enterprise, and that's fine. You have to imagine that 90% of the, I'll kill you for that, must be bluster in the Klingon Empire, because how could you? They couldn't run an empire if everybody was dead.
Right, I think so. And how could you run a starship where everyone is threatened to kill each other over decisions?
Everybody's been stabbed. They're all bleeding to death, yeah. They do kind of address that in Discovery, because there's a part in the third season where I think it's when Georgiou's sick and she's like, I'll kill you if you something. And I killed that guy. And Michael Burnham's like, you didn't really kill all those guys, right? We're kind of popping that. But some of this is bluster, yeah, for sure. There's the as close as we're going to get probably to a Thanksgiving scene, I think, in Star Trek, when they're having the turkey and they're in the captain's dining room. I love that scene. And of course, Curran saying, yeah, OK, give me your burned bird meat. Let's do that.
Oh, yeah, that's a great line. And then when Curran says that this food is too bland for a Klingon stomach, and Geordi says, well, it seems to agree with Worf. And Curran just goes, yes. And that's yes, such a point, does. A great moment. It was just really well performed by all the actors.
Yeah, the taste buds of a warrior. And giving him turkey, I mean, turkey is literally like the blandest food in the world. And he wants to eat spicy food and threaten to kill people. That's why you'd be a Klingon bitter. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Tony Todd's performance in this is great. Of course, you have to give it to Michael Dorn, who, apart from Brett Spiner and I suppose Patrick Stewart, has played this character now for over 30 years. And it just, you don't realize until you watch all of TNG, you get into DS9, how much he is doing with the character. I think Brent Spiner gets a lot of praise because he's, having no emotions, but also he has to show Data developing as a character and continually be that character. But I think Michael Dorn's in a similar situation. He's playing this character who is reserved emotionally. In the first season, every once in a while, he gets to growl at somebody or say, or like when they bring the Klingon sex woman on board, then he's like, oh, he's getting excited. But he's somebody who I think really nails this character, knows this character. And there's just a certain feel that Worf has that is so consistent. And I think it's all down to Dorn.
I agree with you. I think, yeah, Dorn, throughout his career in Star Trek, has always done a fabulous job with Worf and giving making this alien character really relatable, because he's sort of a torn between his love and this idea of sort of the paragon of Klingon virtue, but he wears a Starfleet uniform, and the conflict that he feels because of that, and the way he's able to make that relatable to the viewer. Yeah, it's a really good acting job.
And he's kind of been shortchanged as a character, because he's a character who's been pushed and pulled by the requirements of the franchise for so long that it's hard to figure out where to take Worf or what the character really wants. Every time they do a future thing, he's going to be an ambassador or something. No, we can't do that, because now he's got to be on DS9 or he's going to do something else, but we need to get him in the movies. We have to come up with an excuse why he's on the Enterprise. And I think that's been kind of rough on the future of the character. I mean, Michael Dorn, he's happy. He wants a job. He gets to play Worf, and that's great. But I think out of all the characters that we know, and if we're looking at characters for new shows, like who's got stories left to tell, who's got things to explore, I think Worf is a great candidate for that.
So what do you think would be like the best destiny for Worf then?
Well, I think, just from the practicality of creating a show, I think you have to first off start with, I'm too old for this thing, right? You have to start off with Worf being older. Maybe Alexander's still around. He's dealing with having an adult son. And then you find like some younger character for him to mentor. I think that's probably the way that you would do that. But as far as Worf, that's kind of the problem. I don't know. Him being an ambassador seemed like a great fit for the character, but they kept snatching that out of reach every time they had to use Worf in a new role. So I don't know if ultimately, I think though, there's a deleted line from Nemesis that never gets seen, where he just basically says like, yeah, it turns out I'm not a very good ambassador. And I think I kind of like accept that for him. I think like, yeah, maybe that's not what he's ultimately going to do. I don't know. What do you think?
So, yeah, a diplomat that feels more in keeping with Picard or Spock than it would be with Worf, who I've always thought of as a man of action. I think, you know, one of the weaknesses of the characters, they bring on Alexander and then they show Worf basically trying not to have anything to do with him. And Worf doesn't exactly come out as like a great father over the course of Star Trek. So maybe there could be like a some kind of resolution where Worf sort of acknowledges his failings as a father and makes amends with Alexander or something. I don't know. That might feel like an arc.
Yeah. Also, you know, I think it's telling, and I know it comes down to what you want to present and the production of a TV show, but I think it's telling that when Picard gets in trouble in the Picard series, you know, he doesn't call Worf. So, you know, you'd want Worf at your side killing like Romulan secret agents, right? So I don't know, where is Worf? Maybe he's off somewhere doing something else. Maybe he's missing. You know, we don't know.
The Sins of the Father has that great Worf-Picard moment where Worf asks Picard to be his chadich, and Picard, you know, responds in Klingon. He's like ready and honored and knows exactly what to do. And I love that. I think that really cements a bond between the two characters. And then maybe, you know, when you fast forward to First Contact and you see Picard calling Worf a coward and Worf says, you know, if you were any other man, I would kill you where you stand. Yeah. Maybe that's the moment where that bond that was cemented all the way back in Sins of the Father kind of fractures, you know, irreparably. Maybe.
I think so. Yeah. I also think that Picard is somebody who is so, you know, he's a diplomat. He's gifted in speaking, but he's so good at it that even when he is enraged and he's saying something like that, he's also manipulating Worf. I think he wants Worf to want to fight. And even Worf is like, look, I'm a smart warrior. We should just blow up the ship and leave. But yeah, calling him a coward is like, maybe subconsciously Picard's like, that's how I can get him to get his blood up and want to fight. But I think Worf spent too much time with Picard. He knows that this isn't the right move. The right move is to just leave, retreat, fight another day.
Yep.
I love the scene where Picard is standing up for him as the Chadich, and then Duras comes in and he says something about like, oh, you're just weak. You know, you wouldn't fight back. And he's like, yeah, you can test that assumption whenever you want.
Yep, absolutely.
Step to me. You get phasered.
And I love the way, you know, when Picard is first in the High Council chamber, he sort of speaks loudly and boldly, like he's trying to fit in with the Klingons. But when he's delivering that line to Duras, it's almost at a whisper. And I think he's like pulling Duras into his his orbit. And even though he's not speaking as loudly as he was before, he's very much making a statement that I'm in control here now and I'm not afraid of you.
I also think it's interesting that for a show that is a space show about aliens, and specifically this episode is about like this murderous warrior race, it's kind of a law procedural. It's like an episode of Law and Order in a lot of ways, because there's a trial going on and they need more evidence for the trial. So one of the lawyers, one of the counselors goes out to talk to somebody, you know, in a street scene and get more information about this trial so they can get an advantage.
Yeah, that's sort of speaks to what I was saying earlier and how so much is crammed into this episode. It's, you know, it starts out with Kern on the Enterprise making everyone uncomfortable. Then we then we get this kind of investigation like you're talking about where they're going through communications logs and Picard goes out and interviews Worf's old nursemaid. And then we've got all this stuff in the High Council chambers, like all this stuff crammed into, you know, 40, 45 minutes of television. It's really compressed.
Yeah, and Picard stabs a guy.
Right. There's a couple of stabbings.
Yeah, there's always... Having a Klingon is like having a fun stabby uncle on your ship. But I really like the political side of it. It could be one thing to just find out that, well, of course, the, you know, mustache-twirling evil Klingon's dad did it. Of course he did. And then have the mustache twirler just lunge at Worf and get killed and that's the end of it. But instead there's a big political intrigue element, because when they finally talk to Kempek at the end, he's like, okay, look, here's the deal. Like, Duras's family is super important. He can't go down. Somebody's got to go down for this. So we picked you, you know, sorry. That's what, he's too big to fail. And you're the guy who, you know, lives with the Earth people. So that's what we're going to do. And I think that it's funny that, you know, a warrior race that's all about honor and about you know, being who you are, remaining Klingon Mach, it's like, no, we were going to sell you out. That's what the thing was the entire time. Sorry that you actually acted like a Klingon and came back to face it. If you hadn't, this wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, I mean, I think it really exposes as a lie so much of the concept of Klingon honor.
Yeah. Well, although I love that Worf, before he goes out to accept his commendation, is like, oh, hold on, I'm not ready. Bam, just backhands Duras, and he's like, okay, we can go.
Yep. I mean, that felt, just seeing that felt as good as like seeing Worf stab the guy, or, you know, really thrash him. Just that like one backhanded slap was pretty satisfying.
Yeah, absolutely. And it proves, just without a shadow of a doubt, to his brother that he is the Klingon that his brother wants him to be.
Yep.
That's awesome. As we wrap up here, was there anything else that you wanted to mention about the show? Anything that we left out?
Well, one thing that I really liked about this episode was just I think it's the map painting that we see of the first city of Kronos, and then the set of the High Council Chambers really gave the episode a unique visual identity that's pretty different from anything else that we'd seen in Star Trek to that point. And it was really, you know, you've got that huge Klingon emblem in the background. I think it was just really influential for the, kind of the visual language of how Klingons were going to be portrayed for years after that. Really loved those sets.
Absolutely. I think that Kern gets done a little dirty when he gets his mind wiped in DS9 and kind of disappears. But hey, Michael Dorn's still around. Tony Todd's still around. Let's get this Worf series going. Get Kern his memories back. Help the Worf brothers.
I'd be all about that. I would be on board.
Susie Plaxton's still around. I don't care. It's a sci-fi show. Come up with some way to bring Kalar back. Let's do this. On the last episode, we talked about your space dad, your favorite captain, and the answer was Picard. And one of the things that you liked about Picard is that he raises people to his level, you know, to his standards inspire other people. And I think that's certainly true of what happens to Picard in this episode. And I was thinking, and you kind of mentioned this before, the Shakespearean element of it, but Stewart must have felt really at home in these Klingon scenes with his background at the Royal Shakespeare Theater.
Yeah, I think so. And those scenes where, you know, you're in a council chamber or in a courtroom, you mentioned that there's kind of a procedural element. You know, he gets to have these sort of big moments where his gravitas and just magnetism as an actor are on full display when he's kind of standing toe to toe with Duras. I think that's absolutely a fabulous Picard moment. And the moment when Picard accepts Worf's offer to be his Chadich, I think is also another moment showing Picard's leadership, his willingness to go to bat for his crew.
Yeah, and Kempek, I think, is a little impressed as well by Picard. He sort of sees that, like, no, okay, this normally we wouldn't do this, but this guy seems to know what he's doing and understands the gravity of what we're doing here.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Kempek notes that when Picard speaks up for Worf, and Kempek says has earned the admiration of his commanding officer. That's noted. You know, that's admirable and noted.
Sure.
Yeah.
Can you see? All captains are friends, brothers in arms to their subordinates. But can you see any other Star Trek captain being a good fit for a situation like this?
Boy, I think. You know, I love Ben Sisko, and I think he's got that same, if there's someone that's going to, like, you're going to need to stand toe to toe with a room full of Klingons, I think Sisko is probably that guy who's not going to give an inch and isn't going to be afraid to kind of meet strength with strength. I guess I would pick Sisko if I couldn't have Picard.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good choice too. I was thinking about Archer because he's been in kind of a similar situation when he had the Star Trek VI trial, but he would just mouth off too much and then get thrown into prison like he always does.
Yeah, Archer's weird, man. He always seems to like, he sort of projects his emotional problems on his subordinates sometimes, I think, which is not what I want in a leader. I would take Picard or Sisko in a heartbeat. I take Janeway in a heartbeat.
I think I love Archer, but I think it's telling about his character that, that episode where he's on trial, like most other captains, I think, would have made a speech or found some way to resolve that situation. And Archer just goes down for the crime and ends up in Ruapente and they have to break him out. So that's very telling.
Yep.
Let's see. Now that we've reached the end of the show, you'll receive a promotion to the rank of Lieutenant Junior Grade. Now, you said last time that you were a hotshot pilot on the ship.
Yes, that's right. I would want to be a helmsman.
And I was wondering if Klingon ships are piloted like Federation ships are with buttons.
I would think that there's got to be a joystick on those suckers somewhere, on like a bird of prey. You know, they look so, they look so awesome. They look so dangerous. I would want a joystick.
Yeah. I think that they would really enjoy it because they're all about the feel of battle and being there and just programming a sequence and then having the ship execute it. That wouldn't work for a Klingon warrior. There's a series of LucasArts games from the old days. You know, there was an TIE Fighter game, which was like the Empire version of the X-Wing game. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure there's plenty of, Star Trek fighter pilot Elite Force type games. But I'd like to see like a Klingon version of that where you're flying like a bird of prey, or there's a sequence where you control a, you know, D7 cruiser or a capital ship and just see it from the Klingon perspective.
Oh, totally. I think the Bird of Prey is probably my favorite non-Starfleet ship in the Star Trek canon. I think those are just, dangerous-looking, fast-looking, just a beautiful design.
So, so iconic. Well, Lieutenant Love, thanks for joining me to talk about Star Trek and the Star Trek universe. If people want to continue the conversation, and they can, at EISTpod on Twitter and the Enterprising Individuals Facebook page, where can people find you online?
I'm on Twitter at Trek_Lug. And I have lots of opinions on tabletop role-playing games and Star Trek. And I'm always looking for opportunities to connect with the Star Trek community. So if you want to look me up on Twitter, that'd be great.
That's great. Yeah. And definitely check out Tabletop Frontiers on YouTube. Fred's got a lot of great content and live sessions of role-playing there. Well, thanks again for joining me. We are signing off until the next mission. Hailing frequencies closed.